If you don't like what we tell you to believe in, we'll kill you.
Stuff.biz.
Hey, thanks for tuning in to today's daily show, the first half anyway, with annoying ads interrupting it throughout. You can get away from this by going to therightstuff.biz/paywall and signing up for a subscription. You will be treated to the full show on a convenient RSS feed in one giant file. You'll never have to hear these sales pitches again. And you'll get to comment and use the Bang Forum. What fun! Join us. TheRightStuff.biz/paywall.
All right, welcome. Welcome to Tedious episode. I don't know what episode it is. Like 11 something. 11. I don't know.
It doesn't matter.
Jesse is, or Sven, I should use it as a pseudonym. Sven had a bit of an accident with an appliance this morning, so it might be here for hour two, but if not, we'll just do the show. And I'm actually quite happy that Alex had not heard this story yet, because then we get the pleasure of a visceral react. This is a story that has been going around. It's been making the rounds. It's an absurdity, and we should have a lot of fun deconstructing this. So I'm just going to drop the link into Alex right now.
Right.
We'll just get this visceral react.
What do we got going on here? Black women most likely... Oh, boy. Black women most likely. We're off to a roaring start.
Yeah. See, we're already off to a bad start.
Oh, boy. Most likely to die in medieval plague, Museum of London says. Oh, man.
Right. Now, the subheading says, Black women of African descent were more likely to die in the medieval plague in London, academics at the Museum of London have found. Now, we did this a little bit on Strike and Mike. We're redoing it. I don't care. Like, everyone needs to see this and do visceral reacts to it. We might even just redo it again when Sven gets here. Because this is, I think, because there's so many ironies in this. I'm just going to read, and you can
react. This is my favorite news prompt. Black women most affected by something.
Yeah, but it's
a thing, and black women are hurt most.
But this is something that, like, this is absurd, because we're not talking about... for a second, I want to make sure there wasn't some other plague.
The sun goes supernova. Black women most affected by sun going supernova.
Right. But I was, like, wondering when I was like, is this the... I know there were a few different plagues, you know, eras of the plague in Europe, but there was the main one, which, you know, in England, I believe the years they give here, was it 1348? Yes. 1348 is, I think, the year they're giving here. For 1348 to 1350 was when the Black Plague was most affecting England and the City of London. The City of London Corporation. But, I don't believe them. And we're going to read, and we're going to react to this. So it says, the study is the first archaeological exploration showing how race may have influenced a person's risk of death during what was known as the Great Pestilence or Great Mortality. I thought it was called, like, the Black Death, which, again, if they're literally playing on that, because when I was a kid, they called it Black Plague or the Black Death, and sometimes the bubonic plague, and now I guess they've had these...
Yeah, why are they calling it the Great Pestilence? When did this happen?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it sounds these more anodyne terms that they've come up with here for it. But I'm also like, are you just playing off the fact that it was called the Black Plague? Is it just that dumb? I mean, is that sort of the initial thing that made you think to do? I mean, I think there's an element of that. There's actually an element of that, in my opinion, here. But so let's hear their methodology. The research is based on 145 individuals from three cemeteries. The outbreak is believed to have claimed the lives of 35,000 Londoners. Data on bone and dental changes of the 145 individuals from East Smithfield Emergency Plague Cemetery, St. Mary Grace's and St. Mary Spital, formed the basis of the study. So we're doing phrenology here. We're doing skull measuring.
Yeah, because what I was reading at the head of this article, this is the thing that just jumps out at me, is like, research based on 145 individuals from three cemeteries. Outbreak is believed to have claimed the lives of 35,000 Londoners.
Right. So that's not really a good sample size to begin with, right?
But we're really particularly concerned about these 145 individuals, right. not the 35,000 white Londoners.
Now, if you were to argue that these 145 individuals were like a representative sample, maybe. If you were to actually come up with a much more reasonable hypothesis, a much more reasonable thing you're trying to prove, by looking at the remains of 145 plague victims. But the problem is, you're trying to prove something about demographics. You're trying to prove about a population makeup. And in order to do that, you know, this is a very small sample. But that's not even really the issue. I mean, sure, that's one of the issues, right? But there's myriad here. So it says this primary data was examined by applying a forensic anthropological toolkit to estimate whether the bones were likely to have come from someone with African heritage.
These are nigger bones.
So I thought this was supposed to be pseudoscience, right?
So the thesis here is that you've got like a plague burial plot and you're looking at who's buried there?
Yes, but it gets worse because they're also saying that they compared burial plots. Like one was a normal burial plot and one was an emergency plague burial plot. So one theoretically would have been people just dying of whatever normal things they would have died of, and the other. So they're comparing theoretically plague versus non-plague deaths. I mean, theoretically, it's possible for a plague death to have been buried in the other one. Who knows? Maybe they didn't do that. Maybe they didn't commingle the burials. I don't know. I mean, I guess they would have disposed of plague bodies in a certain way. In any case, their claim is that the report here. Well, let's just keep going. It found that there were significantly higher proportions of people of color and those of black African descent in plague burials compared to non-plague burials. The report said there is a significantly higher proportion of people estimated African affiliation in the plague burials compared to the non-plague burials, 18.4% versus 8.3%. So I'm expected to believe in 1348 London.
What am I supposed to do with this information?
Well, you're supposed to reject it because it's false. I mean, that's my view.
Like, if I
what do they want you to do?
Value, like,
well, we'll get into that.
Are you telling me that slaves had a somewhat higher death ratio during the bubonic plague?
The thing is, I don't even think there would have been African slaves in London at this time.
There were barely any Africans in London at this time.
Right.
Barely any.
And then we have, for the female-only sample, individuals of estimated African population affinity have a significantly higher estimated hazard of dying of plague compared to those with estimated white European affinity. There are no significant associations for any of the other comparisons. The likelihood of dying from the Great Pestilence was highest among those who already faced significant hardship, including exposure to famines that hit England during this time. The research concluded that higher death rates amongst people of color and those of black African descent was a result of the devastating effects of pre-modern structural racism in the medieval world.
How do they know that?
I've never heard of this before.
Pre-modern racism?
In fact, this...
I'm a pre-modern racist.
Well,
return to tradition, pre-modern racism.
But it seems it's no different than any other racism, right? So it seems like there's a number of problems here, right?
Pre-modern racism.
First of all, they're basically measuring like skulls and shit like that, right?
I mean, that itself is kind of pre-modern.
Well, the thing is that like they have apparently here's the actual research. Wait, it's not loading. What the heck? Man, that's really annoying. It's not loading up. I got a crashed window, but I have a link to the actual research paper here. Maybe it'll load up for you. That has some interesting language in it, too.
Pre-modern. This is...
Yeah, pre-modern structural racism. See if you can. Yeah, see what you
pre-modern
get.
Structural racism. Is this what you do whenever you don't actually have like a legitimate field of scientific inquiry? You just do this kind of shit.
Well, this is what you do. This is what you do when you get grants from Jews, I think. And so, what these people have decided to do. I don't know. Did this paper just get withdrawn or something? Because it's just not loading.
Yeah, no, it's not. It's not loading for me either.
Yeah, I don't know.
Maybe they retracted it.
They might have taken it down already because it's a load of crap.
It's so stupid.
Yeah. So.
It's like the more I read about this, the more retarded it is. Dr. Rebecca Redfern, is she an Indian? Dr. Rebecca Redfern from the Museum of London said, "We have no primary written sources from people of color and those of Black African descent."
Right, because they weren't there.
It's like, we don't have any actual written records of any of this.
So there's an article on this from Die Welt, which is like the World, the German paper. They're like repeating, "Black women most likely victims of London's Black Death. The fact that Black women died at higher rates than other people in the plague indicates pre-modern racism, according to a new study." I want to know what if they have an actual link to a copy of this freaking paper. Because yeah, I can't. It's not coming up in this Sci-Hub link, which is annoying because I wanted to actually read from the original paper. Anyway, I don't know. The Sci-Hub page is now just not coming up at all. I don't know. Whatever.
"This research takes the deep dive in previous thinking on population diversity in medieval England based on primary sources." So you guys have been like watching way too many BBC, like Victorian era, modern historicals,
right?
Haven't you?
But even so, we're still like, 500 years earlier in the Victorian era here. Like, so what... Yeah. What are they talking about? Like, so
they're saying nearly 18,000 foreigners had come to London from India, Greece, Iceland, and mainland Europe from 1336 to 1584.
Okay, well,
those
none of those places are Africa.
Yeah, that's not sub-Saharan Africa.
Yeah, and you would have
this
okay
is such fucking strong grasping okay. conjecture. Yeah, like, while no population figures for Black women in London have been recorded.
Yeah.
Paper added that during this period, mercantile and richer migrants who regularly stayed in London, accompanied by entire households, often had servants who were free or enslaved. So you don't even know anything about the life history of these supposed people.
Well,
who
this is what's funny, because they're this is another issue. So they're attributing, think about this, they're saying that somehow these people's health outcomes were adversely affected by pre-modern structural racism, which presumably means that somehow they, because of race, they were like in worse conditions or like something like this, right? But if they're the household slaves of wealthy merchants, frankly, they're going to be living in better conditions than the average poor British person at the same era who's actually living in probably deplorable conditions. Like, think about like an English peasant in 1348 during the time of the plague. And think about like the slave of a wealthy merchant who is living in better conditions.
Hey, what's up? You know you're only hearing half of the show, right? And it's being indiscriminately interrupted with these sales pitches because we just don't know how else to get your attention and get you over there. Our website, our podcasts are 100% listener funded. They are funded with your subscription. So if you could please do that, help us out. therightstuff.biz/paywall. Thanks.
I mean, if you don't have any information on the life history of these hypothetical blacks, how can you make claims that they were victims of a particular type of racism?
Right. Well, like, the claim is because they died more of the plague. Like, it's all circular, right? It's all circular logic. So you
right.
can say,
how do I know that there wasn't just like some sort of genetic issue then?
Well, maybe, right.
Because Africans have a lot of genetic.
Well, that's assuming that we even believe this, which I don't. But like, let's say we do believe that their research actually has uncovered that in this one burial ground, 18.4% of the skeletons belong to blacks. With an emphasis on black women for some other reason that we don't really know.
Why
would you, like, yes, that's actually right. Assuming we even believe that, why wouldn't we assume there was some vulnerability of blacks to this disease? But still, when they even say this from foreigners from Greece, India, Greece, Iceland, and mainland Europe, first of all, they just say they came. They came to London. They didn't say that they stayed there. And so, yeah, none of this works. I mean, and I'm actually very surprised.
Like, bubonic plague kills Africans. Like, right. In Africa. Because, right. Of course.
Because they don't have... Can't you kill bubonic plague, which is normal, like, antibiotic measures? Like, doesn't that work?
I'm not a super amazing expert on bubonic plague because I'm white. I live in a white culture that's pretty much eliminated all of it. It's not something you receive a whole lot of training on these days. Let me do a quick little refresher here. Yeah, it's a bacterium. I thought it was just basic sanitation was kind of the thing.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure it's basic sanitation.
Yeah, and I think that it can also be fought with pretty basic antibiotics. Yeah, yeah, I don't think it's not like a virus or something like that.
I mean, I'm fairly certain it was spread by animals.
Yeah, rats. Fleas. The idea is that it's spread by rats.
So you get rid of the vermin, and then you're going to get rid of your plague.
Right.
Yeah.
But, of course, when a bunch of people are dying in the street, you get more of a rat problem. So it's sort of kind of snowballs. You know,
way more of a problem with pre-modern hygiene and dense living conditions and a whole bunch of other stuff, lack of sanitation.
Right, lack of running water and such like that. So, yeah, and my point is, though, that, like, again, I'm really stuck on a number of issues here. Like, the one being, like, the only context in which you're saying, because you're not even saying, like, first of all, you could say, like, okay, like, a black field slave would be somebody living in shitty conditions. But these aren't field slaves. And I don't know that there was a history of black agricultural slaves in Britain, at least not in this era. I don't think that there was any history.
They don't have anything to work with. 145 right. supposed black people, which they're
No. 18.4% out of 145, they have done what they are calling a bio-anthropological toolkit. To determine that they are, what's interesting here is okay. So this is,
did they really go and like just dig up shitloads of bones?
Yes, they dug up 145 bones, sets of bones, and they applied a forensic anthropological toolkit. No, but listen to this. So it's interesting how they leap. So they say, well, the bones were likely to have come from someone with African heritage. So they use that word likely. It's a weasel word. And then they also have they get even worse further on. They say estimated African population affinity. Estimated African population affinity. But then in the text of the BBC article and in the sort of abstract text of the actual paper, which unfortunately I can't load right now. Maybe they removed it, but it seems like the whole site is down. Probably because people are slamming it to go and look at this dumb paper. I'll bet you that's what it is. They actually just say black. So they're giving you all this equivocal language about estimated African affinity population and such like that. And then, you know, but then they just say black.
Articles everywhere.
Yeah.
If you do a search for black plague right now, this is all you see.
Yeah.
Dumb shit.
Yeah. It's caused a bit of a stir.
All right. Let me see what the Telegraph has to say about
this. Yeah. That should be fun.
That should be really fun.
See what the Daily Mail has to say. They're probably just like, you see, the thing is, the problem this raises for conservatives is like, what are they going to say? What are you going to say in response to this if you're a conservative? You'd be like, no, the people were white. Like, they can't say that. Tories can't say that shit. Tories are like doubled and tripled down on the race ideology to own the libs.
Let's see here. I think so there's something about the Telegraph is implying that they're trying to say that you got to use like analysis of structural racism when you're doing archaeology now.
Well, listen to this. Biological anthropologist from the University of Colorado, Professor Sharon DeWitt, said, not only does this research add to our knowledge about the biological factors that affected risks of mortality during medieval plague epidemics, it also shows that there is a deep history of social marginalization shaping health and vulnerability to disease in human populations. None of that follows. Even if you really did find a few dozen blacks in a cemetery, a plague burial ground in London. Even if you found that, none of that actually follows because, as I said, these would not have been actually socially marginalized. They would have been slaves of the wealthy, and they would have been household slaves of the wealthy, which everybody understands historically. Household slaves of wealthy people lived in the same household conditions as the wealthy people, generally speaking. So yeah. What did they used to be like, okay, now that you're done like making dinner, go and live in like a puddle of shit in the street, like the average right. poor white Briton in the time period? Yeah, like, just, what are you talking about, you know?
Without any knowledge of the life history, all of this is conjecture. The other thing, the Telegraph pointed out that they didn't do DNA testing on any of this stuff.
Right, because that would probably immediately show that they were
Well, wrong. That's, yeah, because it just finds out they're Scots-Irish, but yeah.
Yeah, it would just fine. I don't think that existed then, but yeah, still, effectively, yes.
According to them, it is understood the Museum of London will not conduct any DNA testing of the plague burial remains.
Why not?
Yeah, why not?
Do they give a reason? No.
Is it because last time you guys did this, you found out that the person wasn't black?
Right. I mean, this. I feel like this is like revenge for Cheddar Man. They're like reeling. They're like still reeling from Cheddar Man, and yeah. They're like trying to. They're desperately trying to prove this, and it just like you want to prove something that's not true, and as a result, you're telling lies. Like that's what's going on here.
The intellectual product of these places is dedicated to this kind of stuff.
Right. I mean, what could have been accomplished with this grant money? I mean, you know, who knows? But it's still like, yeah. Yeah, so as with the recent COVID-19 pandemic, social and economic environment played a significant role in people's health, and is most likely why we find more people of color and those of black African descent in plague burials. Except, I don't believe that you do. I just don't believe you. Let me see if I can find this paper on archive. I don't know if they archive.
Well, papers. What I did is I went and I looked up Rebecca Redfern to see like what her academic interests involve.
Yeah.
Changing people. Changing settlements, perspective on urbanism from Roman Britain. There seems to be a little bit of a preoccupation with the idea that these places were way more diverse than they actually
yes,
were.
Yes, that seems to be the focus of her.
Yeah, changing people, changing content, new perspectives on past peoples. There's an ideological premise here that these places had to have been more diverse. Large-scale migration to Britain in the Middle to Late Bronze Age. Yeah, she's very preoccupied with the idea that these places had lots and lots of foreigners.
Right.
England has always been multicultural.
Yep. So here we have Rebecca Redfern, Museum of London Center for Human Bioarchaeology. Of course, bioarchaeology appears to not include DNA testing of human remains. Ancient human remains. Curator of human osteology is what her ResearchGate title says. She likes the bone. Deutsch.
Yeah, probably needs one. All right.
So what are her papers? 73 publications. It's not on ResearchGate. Her latest.
Oh my God! Sex differentials and caries frequencies in medieval London. This bitch was looking into tooth decay between men and women in medieval London. What the fuck?
What saying like what? Like women's had more tooth decay. I mean, I'd imagine you'd probably have more issue with.
My God.
Yeah.
This is like a Tumblr archaeologist.
Oh my God! Listen to this. This is Iron Age predatory landscapes: a bioarchaeological and funerary exploration of captivity and enslavement in Britain. This paper proposed a multidisciplinary approach which can be used to identify captives. And the enslaved of Iron Age Britain, 7th century BC to 1st century AD. It uses the poetics of violence perspective, which recognizes that violence and warfare created and acted through social relations and encompasses violence for which there is... Okay. Encompasses violence for which there is often no archaeological trace. Roman primary sources, bog bodies, and other archaeological evidence from Iron Age Britain and Europe suggest that people in these states of social death were used to acquire material goods employed in the agricultural economy, and their deaths played an important role in episodes of ritual violence. Drawing on research from North America, a series of funerary, isotope, archaeology, and osteological variables have been identified for this period, and when integrated into an osteobiography, allows for reinterpretation. I think she's probably saying that they were like killing faggots. Because wasn't that what the myth of like the bog bodies was, that these were gays?
Yeah.
When they go throw faggots out into the bog. I mean, might not even officially, be entirely true, but yeah.
She's got another paper, officially absent, actually present, bioarchaeological evidence of population diversity. Now, that was in 2019. So she's been angling for this for a while.
She's been using that officially absent but actually present was a subheading or something on this paper as well. This paper is not up on ResearchGate. It's not anywhere. It's not anywhere. And it's not on archive either. It's nowhere. Let me see. Rebecca Renfer, let me look at her academia.edu. Rebecca Redfern hasn't posted lately. Newcastle University, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, yeah, I don't see it. Okay, here we go. Correction to Redfern, written in bone, new discoveries about the lives of Roman Londoners. I'm sure what they're all niggers, right? Just all of them, like... Wait, what? What? I mentioned in one of her papers?
What?
Okay, hold on. The name M. Painovich is mentioned in a paper in Rebecca Renfern's research area. What? What? 239 papers mentioned me? Okay, well, some of these might have been my actual dad's research when he was a professor, but...
That's got to be it.
I'm sure that I'm mentioned in some academic papers.
Concluded that you're a nigger. It's out there.
Wait, I should be able to see. No, I'm not paying you. I should be able to see a paper if I'm mentioned in it. Come on now. Dude, it doesn't surprise me, actually, that this woman would mention me in one of her papers. And I'm sure that the 239 mentioned, some of them are going back to my father's research and citations that were of him. But, like, still.
And she's concluded that you're a Negro.
Yeah.
More diverse than you think you are.
She knew I had, like, a dental work. She knew I had back surgery. She's like, I'm going to do an osteobiography of a racist. Yeah, this is really disappointing that we can't get the paper, because there's a lot of, like, really, really good stuff in there. Let's look at some other stuff, though.
It's always funny whenever you just, like, start going down the rabbit hole on people like this, instead of just taking the article at face value, start digging.
Yeah.
It's like, wow, look how retarded all this is.
Yeah. Yeah, dude. Okay. Yeah, so she's got some stuff about evolution of immune genes and is associated with the Black Death, but I don't know. She doesn't seem to be an actual researcher on that. She's doing all this postmodern crap. I don't know, man. Her method seems to be, what story do I want to write? How can I like use bones like to tell that story? What bullshit can I make up about bones that have been found? So here we go. There's some other quotes from the paper in this German article. Chaucer's Medieval London, A Black London. The researchers found that more people of color and black women in particular were buried in ceremonies for people who died of the plague than those who were not black. Wait, what? Are they actually suggesting that, like, more people that were black died of the plague than non, like, that basically a actual majority? Oh, no, no, they're saying more blacks died of the plague than not. Okay, all right. Again, it's vast majority of black people in medieval London at the time were slaves to wealthy merchants. Okay, again, meaning that they're not living in these deprived circumstances. Chaucer's 14th century medieval London, this is a quote, was a black London, said study author Dorothy Kim, a professor at Brandeis. Let's go Brandeis. In the U.S., Geoffrey Chaucer was, among other things, an English poet, blah, blah, blah. Death of the plague was largely relegated to the least privileged in society, the authors wrote in their study paper, and said their results are an indication of the devastating effects of pre-modern structural racism. Over 50 million people died of the plague, around 60% of Europe's population. At the time, people did not understand how it spread. Research has since shown the plague was passed on by droplets in the air, as understood through COVID-19 pandemic, or rodents carrying infected fleas. A white nostalgia for medieval London. The authors wrote in a study, their work highlights how a substantial community can be erased from history. Or, how a completely invented community can be invented. Like, again, like this is really sloppy intellectual work. And I can't imagine that other scholars believe this and wouldn't just tear this apart if they didn't feel like they might get some kind of consequence. But I wonder if the paper has just been withdrawn, because I can't find it anywhere. Although previous research had noted the multiracial character of British society in medieval times. What previous research? The period is often...
That I did to back up my findings?
Yeah. The period is often falsely considered to have been purely white, they said, referring to a white nostalgia. The white nostalgia is rooted in the same white supremacist ideology that has fed contemporary violence the authors wrote. That's another thing that's not proven. That's a political statement. That is not a factual research statement. What data do you have to show that that is true? That that people that are nostalgic for a white Britain commit racial violence.
Well, it's about the same level of evidence that you'd have that the place was full of black women.
Right, yeah. Likewise, they write. I'm actually glad there's more quotes from the paper in this, because I wanted to read from the actual paper, because there's definitely howlers in there. Medieval studies scholarship has boosted this pre-racial version of the pre-modern past that has allowed medieval culture, societies, writers, and power brokers to hide behind white innocence. Wait, what? When the truth is that race, structural racism was invented, refined, and rehearsed in medieval England. I don't believe you. The researchers said their work offers a pre-modern example of discussions that have taken place since 2020 concerning race and COVID-19 pandemic, which disproportionately affected black people. Right, because black people don't take care of themselves. This research shows there is a deep history of social marginalization shaping health and vulnerability to disease in human populations. While for centuries, the Black Death was considered a universal killer that did not discriminate between its victims, there's a growing body of research, including this latest study, that questions this assumption. I mean, it would be great if any one of these articles would actually link to the original paper. But they don't, and I don't know where.
Yeah, it looks like, I was looking at Twitter. Readers have added context to this story. It's kind of funny. Over 7,000
voters
died of the Black Death in 14th century London. The conclusion that three were black women was made not by DNA analysis, but by looking at the shape of their facial bones. So the people are really pointing out that, like, there's no DNA analysis here. They're just looking at piles of bones. This is provoking quite the ratio on Twitter.
Yeah, and I imagine that I'm also interested to know what method did they use to determine that these were African-affiliated populations, and is that considered a sound method by others in this field of research, by other people that do ancient studies of ancient bones, ancient populations, ancient DNA, you know, other anthropologists, archaeologists, biologists, whatever we want to call them, osteoarchaeologists or whatever the hell we're calling them. Is this method by which they've determined, is this skull measuring technique? And Stryker had mentioned some things like they like certain types of way, like the noses and stuff like this. You know, obviously, you know, you can pretty much tell a white person or a non, at least a non-black person. Actually, no, even Asian people have prognathism too. But blacks tend to have a significant prognathism relative to white people. Maybe it wouldn't be totally conclusive, okay. But
I got a quote from the actual study. I think this is fantastic. The team looked at five features of the skulls, such as the shape of the eye area. By using a forensic data bank covering modern historical populations around the world, explore individuals' probable affinity with different populations. The approach, the researchers say, is an established forensic tool and is not based on controversial methods involving cranial measurements. So it's like, we weren't just measuring the skulls. That would be racist.
But, like, what – I want to know what are the controversial methods involving cranial measurements?
I guess measuring the circumference of the skull.
Yeah, well, the thing that was The thing that was controversial, because you remember Stephen Jay Gould, right? Stephen Jay Gould wrote Miss Measure of Man, and he attacked this anthropologist, I think his name was Samuel Morton. And Samuel Morton had actually done the measuring of not just the skull, but the volume of the skull cavity, right? The brain cavity. And he found that fairly uniformly black Africans had less actual volume in their skull cavity than whites did. And this was, he was accused then by Stephen Jay Gould of actually just falsifying his data in order to reach a predetermined racist conclusion to suit a racist ideology. But as it turned out, none of that was true. And they went back and they looked at his original data and measurements and samples and stuff. And they're like, yeah, he actually was just accurately recording his findings. But that doesn't stop people from still talking about and reading Miss Measure of Man and still saying that Stephen Jay Gould debunked.
Stephen Jay Gould would not have done that if he had been able to look into the future and see that Black Lives Matter would turn on Israel.
Yeah.
He'd have been like, yeah, you know what? They do have fucking small brains.
Yeah. So.
Hello, thank you for tuning in to the free edition of the Daily Shoah on the rightstuff.biz. If you're hearing this message, it's because you're not subscribed, and we need you to change that. See, the rightstuff.biz is 100% listener funded. We have no sponsors. We have no mega donors. We have no shadowy helicopter donors coming in and saving our ass. We need you to support us in our efforts to do these shows. So please navigate to therightstuff.biz/paywall and follow the instructions. Create an account. Create an order. We sell subscriptions monthly, quarterly, twice yearly, and yearly. It's a little bit complicated because of the rampant censorship we've had to endure. So you'll have to pay with cryptocurrency, money orders by mail, e-checks, or you can navigate to my Odyssey channel, create an account on Odyssey, and you can pay me with your credit card. Thank you, and enjoy the first half of the show. Thank you.
So the gist of this is that we couldn't measure the cranium. That would be racist. So we measured the front of the eye sockets, the orbits, all of that, because that's not racist. It just depends on which part of the skull that you're measuring. That determines whether it's racist and invalid or totally fine.
So here's an article from 2019. Has Stephen Jay Gould's The Mismeasure of Man really been discredited? By Simon Witten. Now, this is on Medium, so who the hell knows what this guy's expertise is, but let's see. A century and a half ago, the most learned and conscientious of men believed that the size of the human skull was a measure of a person's intelligence, and that the various subspecies of human being, of which there were multiple, could be objectively ranked into a hierarchy of cranial and hence intellectual capacity. Half the time, a mere 75 years ago, although not unchallenged, this belief remained widespread within the scientific community, albeit crude, and ineffective psychometric testing had by that time replaced the physical measuring of skulls. Why did scientists believe such silly ideas? Wait, hold on a second. Why the assumption that it's a silly idea? Right? Like, why the assumption this idea is silly? It's just because, it's literally because, like, that's offensive, you know? Mm-hmm. But, like, that it's like, no, at least not according to the late evolutionary biologist and science communicator. I love this. Science communicator, Stephen Jay Gould, who argued in his 1982 book, The Mismeasure of Man, that the evidence had simply never been on the side of the skull measure as literal or figurative. It isn't that these early scientists acted dishonestly, while modern scientists possess greater integrity. Indeed, many of these early scientists practice a degree of transparency in reporting their data that sadly surpasses the present-day norm. Instead, argued Gould, such scientists' judgment had been clouded by their socially conditioned expectation that the hierarchies of race and class, of which they found themselves near the top, were the product of natural rather than social forces. As a result, even the most meticulous and honest of these scientists collected and interpreted their data in subtly biased ways. This sounds like an unfalsifiable premise. I want to see where he says that not everyone agrees with Gould. These critics argue the scientific method is robust against the influence of personal prejudices and that Gould is mistaken in the many examples he cites suggest otherwise, and they claim new data that proves it. One recent study by Russell Warren and his colleagues written up in Quillette. Remember Quillette? Is that even still around? By Warren himself, concludes that Gould was incorrect in his finding of bias in the work of early 20th century psychologists who used data from their World War I Army mental tests as evidence of racial differences in innate intelligence. Warren alleges In his Colette article that Gould was committed to ideology over data, that he was mounting a postmodernist attack on scientific objectivity, and accuses him of lying for social justice by distorting evidence and presenting a deceptive analysis, all the while comparing him to a religious fanatic. These allegations follow similar, though slightly more sober, accusations by a team of physical anthropologists in 2011, led by Jason Lewis, who sought to counter Gould's assertion that unconscious manipulation of data may be a scientific norm because scientists are human beings rooted in cultural contexts, blah, blah, blah. So, yeah, it seems like what Gould's critique was sort of like unclean hands, like generally unclean hands, like nothing can be trusted because, you know, everyone will subtly change things to fit preconceived biases, which is, of course, literally what he was himself doing and also is an unfalsifiable premise because you would have to, like, by what method would you prove this? And certainly when it came to Samuel Morton, you can't go back and say that he incorrectly recorded his data or manipulated or falsified his data, which is, I believe, something that Gould claimed. But it's a little bit more complicated than just that, but it really shouldn't be, because basically what Gould is doing is just an unfalsifiable critique of anything. Like, this can't, yeah. you have a bias, you come out of a social context. That social context has certain beliefs and ideas that benefit you socially, so you are literally incapable of recognizing, recording, or documenting data that would undermine your social position. It's kind of it's like, I understand why they say there's like a Marxist element to this kind of postmodernist thinking, because Marx would argue that, like, you know, your class identity determines your political outlook, and you wouldn't be able to not be, like, basically being a bourgeois means you view the world in a certain way, and you're inherently going to be adversarial to proletarians. Of course, in reality, the fact that people that mostly pick up Marxism as an intellectual hobby are, in fact, bourgeois people tends to sort of argue against this, but whatever, it doesn't really matter because it's just... it's just whatever.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, that's just sort of a classic, like, degraded postmodernism as well. Truth is impossible because everybody is just too inherently biased to ever conceptualize what truth is.
But the funny thing is, then, of course, this statement itself, you know, falls under the wheels of its own wagon.
Yeah, it's sort of self-refuting. Yeah.
Yeah, it's like, well, maybe you're doing that too.
Maybe
right?
Your,
like,
premise is also false.
Well, the thing is, it's obviously for them, like, significantly more true. Right, like, for Stephen Jay Gould, it's significantly more true that his viewpoint was fed by bias, and he made significantly more errors than the previous anthropologist that he was critiquing had made. So, like, there you go. And in fact, he actually there's allegations that he actually falsified some of his data, which was their data, falsified what they were saying their data was, and that has since been proven that he did that. Or at the very least, that it was incorrect. I used to be, like, sort of an expert on this back in the day, but there's a whole chapter on Stephen Jay Gould and people like him in Culture of Critique.
Yep.
But anyway, it's interesting, though, because this seems to have been the guy that put the nail in the coffin of the skull measuring, or at least is anything acceptable. But now here we are doing it again. You know, here we are measuring skulls in order to prove the opposite point, right? Now, they're not saying that it's linked in any way to IQ, but I guess one of the critiques of Gould is that, like, hey, you're taking these cranial things, and then you're also correlating them to IQ tests, and we're just going to gish gallop and do tactical nihilism on IQ testing forever. Like, we'll never acknowledge that it's valid, so it doesn't matter. You know, so, yeah. So what are you out there?
Well, there's a related story.
What is that?
It's another museum. It's another museum doing something that's kind of stupid. They are reclassifying Elagabalus as a tranny.
Well, I will say this. There is more of an argument for this.
There is.
However,
what?
However,
do you want to tie your wagon to that particular horse? That's the question.
Well, no. My point is this. The idea of a trans woman and transgender doesn't make sense in this context, because that kind of ideology like gender ideology, Jewish gender ideology of this era did not exist then. However, there is a strong tradition. And again, understand that critiques of Roman emperors are actually, and all historians understand this, critiques of Roman emperors, attacks on them, nasty things written about them by contemporaries that then get picked up and carried down through history, are viewed a little bit more skeptically now than they have been in the past. However, with Elagabalus, there's really no alternative tradition. The tradition about Elagabalus is that he was, first of all, he wasn't, first of all, he was a boy king. He was, I forget the exact, oh, man, I would have read up a little bit on this part of.
I watched a video about him from Metatron earlier this year, because he goes over the ancient sources. Like, it's Cassius Dio, who's the one who basically claims this guy was kind of equivalent to like a tranny or something. But
right.
The overall point that was made is like to claim him as transgender for your team is exactly like claiming like Buffalo Bill from
Yeah, Science that's
Lambs.
That's kind of the point, right? That's the
like,
funny
this
thing.
Dude, you don't want to be associated with this guy.
Right. That's the thing is that is actually like see I was going to say, cuz I saw some people on Telegram that reacted negatively to this, particularly right after reacting negatively to the other thing, and I understand why they do, particularly if you just see a headline that says UK Museum reclassifies Roman Emperor as transgender. Now, I would immediately think, now, if you're not that familiar with the history of Rome, or every emperor, which a lot of people, there's a lot of emperors that people don't know anything about, and Elagabalus is by far one of the more obscure ones, you're going to immediately be like, are you fucking kidding me? Like, are you kidding me? They're doing this now, right? There's good reason to think that Elagabalus dressed as a woman and was homosexual, or at the very least was an abused child, because he became emperor when he was 14 and he was thrown into the Tiber when he was 18.
Right. And he was basically a foreigner, right?
Yes, he was an Easterner.
He was worshiping some other god or something. He had a different religion.
So
it was just...
So the Severan dynasty, which came after the Marcus Aurelius, who was like the last good emperor, then his son Commodus was a mess, mm-hmm. total mess. Yep. After that, there was like a civil war, and the Severan dynasty took over. Now, the Severan dynasty's Septimius Severus and then his son Caracalla, they were known as like really brutal but very like efficient. You know, like they were like, if you were just a normal like Roman person, like just an average Roman or a peasant or something, you wouldn't have had a problem, because these guys like clean shit up, right? They were brutal but efficient. And then I think that after that, there was some kind of degeneration and some intrigue with women involved and assassinations. And like Caracalla, I think, was pretty brutal and he got killed. I have to look at the history again. I can't remember it exactly. I'm not as familiar with this era as I am with the Julio-Claudian era. Anyway, he was what they would call Eastern. And he had been raised in the East. So he probably was like Phoenician or Arab or something like that. He was probably kind of brown, right? He wasn't as white as the Romans would have been. But they would have seen people, you know, or he might have also just been white, you know, because even then, like people that they called like Syrians and stuff like that, like they would have been relatively white or, you know. but in any case, he wasn't Roman. He was Eastern.
Yeah.
And he came in and he declared himself the incarnation of this Eastern sun god called Heliogabalus or Elagabalus.
Yep, Heliogabalus, yep.
And this is, it's basically a typical ancient world sun god cult. Not that different, but he, of course, was like no other religions but the sun religion and I'm the god. And that kind of thing happened occasionally in Rome, and no one ever liked it. And any emperor that did that was kind of like, yeah, you're not going to last too long. Whenever you do this, whenever an emperor does this, you know, the Praetorians take him out at some point, right? And then, like, because it gets to the point where the people are like, yo, are you fucking kidding me? And also, your Praetorians are like, but the Praetorian Guard was so corrupt by the end of it. In any case, yes, he was known for being a... The other thing is, like, there's nothing but bad shit about this guy in the tradition.
This guy was a lunatic. I mean, closely related to these irregularities was – this is from Cassius Dio, by the way. Closely related to these irregularities was his conduct in the matter of Elagabalus. The offense consisted not in his introducing a foreign god into Rome or in his exalting him in very strange ways, but in placing him before Jupiter himself and causing himself to be voted as priest – also in his circumcising himself and abstaining from swine's flesh, on the ground that his devotion would thereby be pure. He had planned, indeed, to cut off his genitals altogether, but that desire was prompted solely by his effeminacy. His circumcision, which he actually carried out, was a part of the priestly requirements of Elagabalus, and he accordingly mutilated many of his companions in like manner. Furthermore, he was frequently seen, even in public, clad in the barbaric dress which the Syrian priests use, and this had as much to do as anything with his receiving the nickname of the Assyrian.
Still listening to this version of the Daily Shoah? Still haven't subscribed? Please, go over to therightstuff.biz/paywall, grab a subscription, and you won't be interrupted with these sales pitches ever again.
Looks like he put up some sort of false statues and stuff.
Yeah, so Edward Gibbon, who wrote the epic Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, which is actually quite an enjoyable read. You'd be surprised. And that was written in the late 18th century, it was 1780s around that it was written. It's a great book, and it's written in kind of flowery language, but he has this. He has this on Elagabalus, his profligate and effeminate luxury. A rational voluptuary adheres with invariable respect to the temperate dictates of nature and improves the gratifications of sense by social intercourse, endearing connections, and the soft coloring of taste in the imagination. But Elagabalus, I speak of the emperor of that name, corrupted by his youth, his country, his fortune, abandoned himself to the grossest pleasures with ungoverned fury, and soon found disgust and satiety in the midst of his enjoyments. The inflammatory powers of art were summoned to his aid. The confused multitude of women, of wines, and of dishes, and the studied variety of attitudes and sauces served to revive his languid appetites. New terms and new inventions in these sciences, the only ones cultivated and patronized by the monarch, signalized his reign and transmitted his infamy to succeeding times. A capricious prodigality supplied the want of taste and elegance. And whilst Elagabalus lavished away the treasures of his people in the wildest extravagance, his own vice and that of his flatterers applauded a spirit and magnificence unknown to the tameness of his predecessors. I mean, this is like very, this language is very much, to confound the order of seasons and climates, to sport with the passions and prejudices of his subjects, and to subvert every law of nature and decency were in the number of his most delicious amusements. A long train of concubines and a rapid succession of wives, among whom was a Vestal Virgin, ravished by force from her sacred asylum, were insufficient to satisfy the impotence of his passions. The master of the Roman world affected to copy the dress and manners of the female sex, preferred the distaff to the scepter, and dishonored the principal dignities of the empire by distributing them among his numerous lovers, one of whom was publicly invested with the title and authority of the emperor's, or as he more properly styled himself, of the empress's husband. So it seems like what he's saying here is he actually pretended to be a woman and have a husband as one of his like perversions. But here's one thing that that Gibbon says. Now, I know the language is a little bit archaic here, but it's funny. It may seem probable the vices and follies of Elagabalus have been adorned by fancy and blackened by prejudice. Yet confining ourselves to the public scenes displayed before the Roman people and attested by grave and contemporary historians, their inexpressible infamy surpasses that of any age or country. The license of an Eastern monarch is secluded from the eye of curiosity by the inaccessible walls of his seraglio. I don't know. I guess that's his like sanctum. The sentiments of honor and gallantry have introduced a refinement of pleasure, a regard for decency, a respect for the public opinion into the modern courts of Europe. But the corrupt and opulent nobles of Rome gratified every vice that could be collected from the mighty conflux of nations and manners. So basically, he's actually saying like, nah, like people might be saying that people might say that people were just hated him because they're hating on him. But it appears that that's not the case. Like, he actually was really bad.
Yeah, because that's always a thing with, like, Roman history, right? Is that they tend to be a little creative with the kinds of things they say about people.
And this has been invoked. This principle has been used. This has been used. This principle of taking a skeptical eye to these accounts. Like, Caligula is one who there's been some revisionist work done on. However, unlike with Elagabalus, with Caligula, There is, and also with Nero, with both of these, who are both known to have also been crazy, out of control, like thought they were gods, whatever. Nero particularly, there's an alternative tradition that just has describes him as like a good emperor. And actually,
yeah.
And of course, the Nero thing gets amplified by Christianity, who turned Nero into a devil, like a devil figure, like a hate figure, you know, number of the beast and all that stuff, right? Which many people think is actually talking about Nero in the Book of Revelations, that they're actually talking about Nero with some of that stuff. That could be true or false. I don't know. I just know it's a theory. And then Caligula, there's also some a tradition from earlier on when he was emperor that does talk about him doing pretty normal stuff and not being like a crazy lunatic. And that there could very much so the stuff about him could be invented by anti-Caligula partisans. But you don't have any alternative tradition with Elagabalus. It's all the same. It's yeah. all like this guy.
Yeah, there's basically like three accounts. There's Cassius Dio, Herodian, Historia Augusta, which is, I suppose, that's the least trustworthy account. But all of them are pretty similar in the way they describe him. Like this one from the Historia Augusta is like, this line I thought was pretty interesting. He declared, furthermore, that the religions of the Jews and the Samaritans and the rites of the Christians must also be transferred to this place in order that the priesthood of Elagabalus might include the mysteries of every form of worship. I'm willing to believe that. I'm willing to believe that he had Jewish rites in his temple. Okay.
Yeah, and of course he was, you know...
That tracks.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think this is one you can necessarily pin on the Jews, but like... No. He was bringing in, because he was doing the bit of like, I'm the God, all of your shit is actually just worshiping me, so just come and worship me, which probably, again, you're going to piss a lot of people off when you do shit like that. That's like the first step. I mean, it's funny because in Rome, in the history of Rome, the emperors that do that sort of thing, because they all sort of, in the official Roman state religion, theoretically, you become like a god if you're the emperor, right, afterwards. The Senate votes you to be a god, wherever you're a god, right? But like those that did this in real life, like in to be like in real life a god, it never ends well. Like they always end up getting murdered.
Augusta, I mean, yeah, this probably is a little bit more of a dramatic account here, but the opening is pretty funny. The life of Elagabalus Antoninus, also called Varius, I should never put in writing, hoping that it might not be known that he was an emperor of the Romans.
Yeah, right.
Like I regret even writing about this. I don't want people to know that he was a Roman emperor.
So apparently, according to Cassius Dio, Elagabalus schemed to make a former slave and chariot driver Heracles not just a partner in bed, but in power by naming him Caesar, and him he named him emperor and himself empress. So yeah, that's
the main things I'd have to pull up. There's a great video by Metatron on this, but the part where he allegedly said, call me not Lord for I'm a lady, that's what these fucking trannies and queers right. always point to.
Right. But I'm like, okay, look, I'm actually willing to give him to you.
Right. I mean,
I'm willing to agree and amplify on this. And maybe, you know, if they're saying that if they're just believing the tradition in which he says that he asked to be called a lady, then okay, yeah, sure. But again, Elagabalus was universally reviled. He was known for being a pervert, indulging in the most ludicrous and insane and grotesque pleasures with, like, all kinds of vigor. If you listen to Gibbon, you know, his flowery English talking about this, like, he was hated by everyone. And eventually, he was just thrown into the Tiber. He had enough, and he just threw him in the river. And
he had a bloodthirsty assassination. He was on the toilet, and they grabbed him. He was hiding on the toilet.
You're right, right. So I'm actually kind of curious how that came about. I haven't read any of this stuff in a while. So
yeah, because this wasn't somebody that people really focused on a lot, because he just was not super. I mean, he had a fairly short reign.
Yeah,
universally reviled.
Mm-hmm.
And he's only kind of back in the headlines because the trans community has decided that they should adopt him.
Yeah, so the Wikipedia says this under marriage, sexual orientation, gender identity. Question of Elagabalus' sexual orientation and gender identity is confused owing to salacious and unreliable sources. Really? Really? But Cassius Dio is known as pretty reliable. And again, all of these historians have their critics, right? And Dio is known as a pretty good one. And actually, it's a pretty good read too. If you pick it up and read a good translation of it, it's much easier to read than Gibbon. I like Gibbon just because I find his English fun to read, but it is a bit of a chore. But Cassius Dio states that Elagabalus was married 5 times, twice to the same woman. His first wife was Julia Cornelia Paula, who he married prior to 29th August 219. Between then and 28th August 220, he divorced Paula, took the Vestal Virgin Julia Aquilia Severa as his second wife, divorced her. I guess she would have been related to the Severan family. Took a third wife, who Horanian says, blah, 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 blah.
That was the thing, is he took a Vestal Virgin as a wife, which was...
Yeah, that's going to really piss people off. And he did it just to piss people off.
Yeah.
So Dio states that another husband of this woman, Elagabalus, was Heracles, an ex-slave and chariot driver from Caria. The Augustan history claims that Elagabalus also married a man named Zodocus, an athlete from Smyrna. While Dio says that only Zodocus was his cubicularius. It's like a eunuch. Dio says that Elagabalus prostitute himself in taverns and brothels. That might be a bit much, but you never know with these guys, right? Sometimes they like to slum it. Dio says Elagabalus delighted in being called Heracles' mistress, wife, and queen. The emperor reportedly wore makeup and wigs, preferred to be called a lady, not a lord, and supposedly ordered vast sums to any physician who could provide him with a vagina by means of incision. Okay, what is the source on that?
There's only one source there's one out of the three, and it is Cassius Dio.
That he actually says that?
Yeah, he alleged that he carried his lewdness to such a point that he asked physicians to try a woman's vagina's body by means of an incision, promising them large sums for doing so. But there's only one source for that. Maybe they made
Jesus
that up.
Jesus Christ.
But what is known is that he was hated.
Yeah.
He was engaged in apparently like very serious levels of sexual degeneracy, to the point that nobody's really lying about that. Nobody's exaggerating. Like this guy was severely fucked up, and he was implicated in some murders. That's what I was trying to look for.
I'm sure he was.
That was the thing Metatron was pointing out. It's like, no, this guy was a murderous lunatic.
Of course they all were, because if you think you're a god and you and you're engaging in all of this weird shit, somebody's going to say something and you're just going to say, kill them. Right? You're just going to have them killed. So apparently his grandmother was the one that decided that he had to go. Because that he and his mother, who was encouraging his behavior, had to go. And then replaced him with her other daughter's son, Severus Alexander. Who, after they threw this dude in the Tiber, they put this other guy on the throne. Yes. And apparently, the story is, the tradition is, that she tricked Elagabalus into appointing his cousin as Caesar, and then she had him killed. So, yeah. All this stuff is, like, highly entertaining, even if a lot of it is embellished to make it more like a crazy soap opera, you know? It's still highly entertaining. Following his assassination, the associates of Elagabalus were killed or deposed. His lover, Heracles, was executed. His religious edicts were reversed. The stone of Elagabal was sent back to Emesa. Women were again barred from attending meetings of the Senate. The practice of damnatio memoriae, or erasing from the public record a disgraced personage formerly of note, was systematically applied. In his case, several images, including over life-size statue of his Hercules, now in Naples, were recarved with the face of Alexander Severus. Here's the who is this from? What is this a quote from? From Dio, he made an attempt to flee and would have got away somewhere by being placed in a chest had he not been discovered and slain at the age of 18. His mother, who embraced him and clung tightly to him, perished with him. Their heads were cut off and their bodies, after being stripped naked, were first dragged all over the city, and then the mother's body was cast aside somewhere or another while his was thrown into the Tiber. Somewhere or another, you know, lost track of it. I mean, I guess if you're in...
say this guy was not particularly liked by the population.
Yeah. So I'm willing to give them Elagabalus if they want to take him. And if they're basing... I mean, the thing is, it's sort of like, you can argue, like, the Black Death thing, the Black Plague, Black Death thing. It's like, yeah, that's obviously, they're literally making shit up. They have no sources. The anthropological record probably doesn't prove what they want. They're refusing to use DNA evidence. They're literally just making shit up. In this case, they at least have a historical document from, if not exactly at the time, relatively close to the time. I don't know exactly when Dio was. I think it was later, though.
There is a. I'll link this in the show notes, but there's a 24-minute video from Metatron. I remember watching this when this shit was first kicking off a few months ago, and he goes through every source and great detail about this. And yeah, his conclusion was like, no, this guy was like literally murderous. Like he was a bad human being. Mm-hmm. Why would you want to associate yourself with this? Are you just hoping that people see, oh, Roman Emperor was a trans person? Or worse, are they going to try to rehabilitate this dude?
Actually, you know, I have to take it back. Dio, Cassius Dio lived from 165 to 235. So he would have been at the peak of his writing exactly when Elagabalus was emperor. He would have witnessed all of this himself with his own eyes. So he was an actual contemporary witness to this. He wasn't just writing another history 100 years later. Because a lot of times people think, oh, this was written by a Roman historian. That means that he like was witnessing what he says. No, it's like not true at all. Like like Dio talks about stuff that happened 700 years before he was born, you know, in his history. So yeah, or Dio, I don't know, Dio, Dio, whatever, whatever you want to do with that.
Yeah, the story implies that this guy was named Varius because he didn't know who his father was. Like his mother was such a slut. I mean,
they called him Varius. So like, who's your father? Yeah, various possibilities here. That's funny.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know.
That's a bit more of a sensational account, but still.
Yeah. So let me see. What are they actually saying? UK Museum. UK Museum says it will be heeding research that reveals the ancient emperor Elagabalus was transgender and will subsequently be referring to the ruler as she. See, this is actually retarded. That's actually retarded. That they're going to, that now you're going to be calling, they're going to be pretending like Elagabalus was actually a woman, because they're now interpreting their gender ideology on back with what was universally understood in ancient Rome, and frankly, universally understood until like last year, was just a pervert. Right, it was just a disgusting, sick pervert. Now, I would have said that he's a tranny, but I wouldn't call him a she. Anyway.
Elagabalus also sacrificed human victims, and for this purpose, he collected from the whole of Italy children of noble birth and beautiful appearance, whose fathers and mothers were alive, intending, I suppose, that the sorrow suffered by two parents should be all the greater. Now, maybe that's an exaggeration, but it is a claim being made.
Right. I mean, it's possible some of these claims are exaggerated. But again, we don't have any alternative tradition for this emperor. And he did end it, you know, he ended like he was gone after, you know, from when he was 18 years old and replaced by his 15-year-old cousin, you know, at the sort of connivance of his grandmother. Like, that's all true. So, you know, what other explanations you got?
I mean, yeah, that's the thing, is like it or not, like there is a historian from that general era who made that claim that he was engaged in human sacrifice. Like, do you want to associate transgenderism with human sacrifice?
I don't think they care, dude. Because remember, they don't really care. Like Audrey, they were owning Audrey Hale. You know, like, because their thing is like, it doesn't really matter what the person did, like the gender identity is gender identity, and you just have to respect it. Like, you know, my thing is like, but again, there's also a connection between these things, right? Like the weird perversions that Elagabalus engaged in and being a tranny, if we want to use that term, I'm fine using it for this. Although I wouldn't say that he was actually a woman, he's a perverted, fucked up guy. But the fact that he was perverted and murderous is intimately linked to this mental illness, because this is even true today, that trannies are more likely to actually have done violent crimes than non-trannies. Significantly so. So, yeah.
What the fuck? This is great. So he appeared on some coins, and I didn't know this. There's a discussion around these coins that's fantastic. Check this out.
Is Elibet Gavilis really wearing a desiccated bull phallus on his head? Yeah, I would imagine he probably is. That's the kind of shit that... See, here's the thing. I'm not even going to say that means he was gay or something, because that's the kind of shit that people would do back then. People would just do that type of shit. One of these Elagabalus with horn coins has been on my want list for years. I was very happy to pick up a wonderful example from AMCC3. This coin has great centering, toning, detail, very respectable provenance that is made all the nicer by its connection to... what really makes this coin interesting is a question. What is Elagabalus wearing on his head? Answer one, it's a horn. This interpretation was first put forward by Henry Cohen in 1859, based on the fact that Hellenistic kings are sometimes shown in art with two horns on their heads. This view is also shared. Oh, man. Anyway.
Answer two, though. Oh, my God. Answer two is...
Well, here's the funny thing. There's this picture of Moses with horns. There is a tradition of horns in imagery in the ancient world, which is linked to something or another. I have to look it all back. This is all stuff I used to know, you know, back when I was actually... Answer two, it's a dried bull's penis. As crazy as this theory sounds, at first glance, a compelling case was made for it by the very knowledgeable numismatist Elke Kringle. I guess he's probably Jewish too. Let's be honest. Numismatist, that's like a coin studier. The article is widely available online, but it's written in German, so I took some time to translate it as best as I could in order to understand and summarize the theory here. The theory is that a bull penis was dried and attached to the headgear worn by Elagabalus during sacrificial rites. It is assumed that a new specimen would have been needed for each sacrifice. During the research on this theory, tests were carried out to determine if a dried bull penis could explain the size and shape variations seen on the coins, and it was determined that it could. You can go to the original research photos, or else just trust me on this one. He has a link. Oh, okay. There seems to be a link or a source here. Connection of wearing the object as part of a sacrifice seems very strong to me. On the earliest issues showing the object as part of the portrait, the reverse sacrifice scene also clearly shows the emperor with it on his head. Rarely the reverse will not show a sacrifice scene, but the obverse will have the object bull penis. Even in these cases, it can be argued that the reverse always shows the emperor in a function of state that a sacrifice would have followed. Possibly the least compelling component of this theory is the somewhat weak connection between cult practices of Elagabal and known instances of the use of a phallic headdress. Even so, Kringle makes a case that it was a known phenomenon in Syria and Eastern Mediterranean at the time. Kringle points to figurines of Jupiter, Heliopolitanus, with a phallic-shaped object on his head, as well as bronze figurines of a male head top with male genitalia that have been found in Syria and across the empire. Okay. There's more.
Assyrian. I mean, that was a nickname for him, so there you go.
Yes, he was Eastern, as they said, or Syrian, yeah, or something like that, or from that area. You know, a lot of Romans lived out in that area.
I'm just trying to imagine, like, I guess they're going to a butcher or something. Like, yeah, I need some bull penises. What do you need all these bull penises for? Oh, it's complicated. It involves a Roman emperor.
I mean, there's a link to this paper here, but I can't read German, so it doesn't have. It's like. It seems to actually not be going to it. I don't know. I have no idea what's going on here.
At any rate, I do find that paper to be more interesting than the first
page.
One
could not be found. It. Yeah.
All right.
So that the penis, the dried bull penis pictures are no longer available. So yeah, that's interesting. But so is this definitely? I guess that's definitely him. Yeah. Okay. Dried bull penis. Anyway,
yeah, that's what you want to associate your transgender stuff with.
Look, I don't see why they would have a problem with that.
Guy's got a fucking dried bull penis on his.
I don't think they would have a problem with that. That's not something that's out of the ordinary. I don't think they'd have a problem with any of it. Frankly, I don't think that the way that we all know that trannies are basically, you know, lunatic narcissists and if not narcissists, whatever, they're just crazy people. Crazy people with main character syndrome. Every tranny has main character syndrome. Elagabalus obviously had a serious case of main character syndrome. you know, they're all like into weird, wacky shit. They don't care about other people. They're willing to take pleasure in other people's suffering. I mean, look at the kinds of cartoons they draw about Stone Toss. Look at that shit. Like, they're all lunatics. Trannies are lunatics. So Elg Atlas fits perfectly.
You know what's interesting, though, is this museum, they're not using that coin. They're using a different coin. They're using one of the earlier ones.
Oh, yeah?
It's like, nah, let's not use the bull penis coin.
I don't see why they shouldn't use it. I mean, what's to be ashamed of here? This is just like something that, you know, like, really, like, there's no judgments here are made. I mean, you know, like, this is a standard bull phallus party. You know, we call it
sacrifice two children for their parents.
Yeah, I've gone through three desiccated bull penises since we last spoke. you know, there's no real issue here. I don't see why you would want to like hide anything. Well, I mean, this guy was an out and proud, open transgender in the Roman Empire. Let him be him. Let him be him. Like, why are you trying to cramp his style? You walk around with a bull penis on his head. You know, that's who's gonna tell him no. You know, it's like this is. You know, I'm tired of this.
Guy is wearing makeup. He's got a bull penis on his head. He's gonna sacrifice some children.
Yeah.
Gay pride.
And this is a history of the LGBT community. In the past, inaccurate translations had referred to Elagabalus as they. However, we now know this is a result of the classical Greek language making no distinction between gender when referring to people in the third person. No, making many translations inaccurate?
I mean, they were woke to, like, pronouns back then.
Yeah.
They asked what the pronoun was.
Let's see this. So the actual article that talks about the Art newspaper that says, Elagabalus is considered one of the most controversial Roman emperors. Elagabalus was also known to have married a man, the charioteer and former slave Heracles. They loved being referred to as Heracles' wife or mistress. The emperor is also reported to have frequently worn wigs and makeup, preferred to be called Domina over Dominus. Yes, so an interview published in 2021, I see Elagabalus, the trans emperor of Rome from February 2021. For LGBTQIA plus History Month, recent ancient history graduate Ollie Burns explores the life of one individual who may confuse what we know about gender nonconformity in the ancient world. Actually, frankly, none of this is confusing to me. The fact that Elagabalus, who I've known about for a long time, just because I've known Roman history for a long time, it was one of my, you know, when I was in college, I studied ancient history, and it's also just been a hobby of mine for a long time to read about it. So, you know, this is one of the lesser known eras of Roman history. People are much more familiar with, like,
right,
Caesar, the Roman Revolution.
Some stuff today. Like, yeah. We learned a lot today. The guy's wearing a bull penis on his head. That's new.
That was new to me, yes. But very it doesn't surprise
deep
me.
Deep lore.
It doesn't surprise me. People, look, I'll be honest with you about this one thing. People in the ancient world used to do some shit like that. Even like non-trannies. Like, there would be people that would be wearing, like, penises around their neck and shit. Not real ones, but, you know, they would have, like, little, yeah. You know, you had, like, Herms, you know, these things.
Before you had the truck nuts that you hung off the back of your tailgate, off the bumper there, you just wore the penis.
Yeah.
His necklace.
You know, people used to put good luck charms of, like, you know, little characters with, like, big erect penises out in front of their homes to, like, give travelers, like, a good luck charm on their way. You know, these are called Herms. It's supposed to be Hermes with an erect penis. It's like a good luck charm for travelers. So this is, you know, people used to do some shit like that.
Yeah.
I went to Pompeii, and I was walking around, and I saw a couple of buildings that had giant dicks scrawled on the wall. It was just there, you know? Just the graffiti was still there. So, you know, these things happen, I guess.
Right.
But anyway, all right, we'll take a break here. We'll see if Jesse has his...
We've done enough ancient history.
Yeah, if Jesse has the appliance repaired for next hour, we'll see. Anyway.
You're listening to TDS on the right stuff.
Doc Biz.